In this episode of Blue Dot, we talk to Rolling Stone contributing editor Jeff Goodell about his powerful new book, The Water Will Come. Goodell travels around the world examining sea level rise and how it's not just something to deal with in the future, but how it's manifesting itself even now. Join us. Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlohm. Inexorable. The dictionary defines that word as impossible to stop or prevent. That's exactly the takeaway message I got about sea level rise after reading The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World by Jeff Goodell. Jeff's a contributing editor for Rolling Stone magazine. His previous books include How to Cool the Planet, Geoengineering, and the Audacious Quest to Fix Earth's Climate, and Big Coal, the Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. Jeff joined us via Skype. Jeff Goodell, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you are a writer for Rolling Stone magazine, yes?
Yes, I have been a writer of Rolling Stone for 20 years, believe it or not.
Wow. I want to know, what first got you interested in sea level rise, both as a person and a journalist?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I had been writing about climate change for about 15 years, covering all kinds of things from the Paris negotiations to, clean energy, to the coal industry, to drought and all kinds of things. But I kind of knew about sea level rise, but I it was sort of just one of those things. It was sort of an abstract kind of idea for me. And, you know, it's not something that I gave a lot of thought to until Hurricane Sandy hit New York City. I wasn't in New York the day it hit, but I was there a couple of days after, and I was wandering around the Lower East Side and, stunned by the damage that I saw and the kind of, just seeing what 9 feet of water could do to Lower Manhattan. And I was thinking about it as a journalist, about how I was going to write about this. And I talked to a scientist at Columbia University, and he said to me, one of the ways that you could think about this is as a kind of dress rehearsal for sea level rise, because imagine that 9 feet of water that came into Lower Manhattan, which is about the high end of what the projections are for the end of the century for sea level rise, imagine that water came in and never went out. And that's what sea level rise would be like. And then he said, if you really want to, scare yourself about this, go have that same thought exercise down in Miami. And I went down to Miami and I did. And that's really where the book was born.
Wow. Well, we were talking earlier, your mother lives not far from me, and you were here for Thanksgiving in Red Bluff, California, yes?
Yes, I've been coming to Red Bluff since I was a little kid, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I have just a little short story for you that I'd thought of earlier before I even knew that you were here at Thanksgiving. I was brining a turkey for Thanksgiving dinner, and it was in an ice chest with a big plastic bag, and it was in the salt water. And somehow the bag got punctured and the bag started to leak into the ice chest, and the ice chest started to leak out. And I was trying to stop the leaking. And, here's a pretty large ice chest full of water, and I cannot stop this leak. The force of this water coming out is just, I can't stop it. And then suddenly, this garage is full of briny water. And I was thinking to myself, boy, the power of water, at that small scale, when you scale that up to oceans, you mentioned that, this is as real as gravity. Give us a sense of how powerful forces we are dealing with here.
Well, I mean, one of the most memorable things, a scientist said to me while I spent 3 years, reporting this book, and he said to me, we were talking about various ways that cities can defend themselves and build seawalls and things like that. But he said, ultimately, remember, you never want to fight a war with water, because water always wins. And he said, just look at the Grand Canyon. And the Grand Canyon is a great example of just the sort of power of water in the same way that you're talking about it. I mean, that enormous canyon was cut by just, the sort of meandering of the river over millions of years. And, you see this when you look at what just even high tides and what a modest storm surges and things can do to coastlines. I was just in Florida a couple of weeks ago looking at some of the damage from Hurricane Irma around St. Augustine, which didn't even have that. It wasn't even that, by the time I got up there, it wasn't even that big of a hurricane. And yet, you know, it just like wiped away, you know, these beaches, it cut into these roads, wiped out a bunch of houses. I mean, you know, one of the things about sea level rise is that it's, you know, it's a sort of inexorable force, you know. It's not something that is going to be like a high tide that comes in for a while and you run away from it and then it goes back out and the water's where it used to be. The fundamental thing that's happening here is that the seas are getting higher and higher and they're not going to be going down. They're just going to be going up higher and higher. And the question is, how high are they going to go and how fast will they go?
You mentioned Hurricane Irma, and we had these tremendous hurricanes this year with Maria, and especially Harvey, you know, which was such a major flooding event. In your book, you're talking about a slower, more inexorable type of flooding along coastlines, but they really do give us a preview of what's to come, don't they?
Yeah, and, you know, 2 points that are important to make is, one is that even, you know, modest amounts of sea level rise makes these big storms like Harvey and Irma and, you know, Sandy and all these other ones more and more damaging because the water is higher and higher and it pushes in farther and farther. But the other thing is that, you know, you don't have to, it's not like sea level rise is not a problem until a city or a place becomes, you know, the new Atlantis. I mean, even modest, even, you know, a few inches of sea level rise, you know, causes more coastal erosion, more roads wiped out, more houses washed away, you know, and it becomes very, very expensive for cities and states and counties to deal with this. I mean, we're talking about Northern California. I was just in Half Moon Bay like a month ago, and I gave a talk at this conference at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel there that's built right on the water. And that hotel is already in huge trouble because the cliff that it's built on is eroding away so fast. I mean, they were actually doing repair work to try to, you know, slow the erosion of this, you know, hotel worth hundreds of millions of dollars that's on the verge of falling into the Pacific Ocean. And that's because of the increasing storm surges and increasing damage from these rising seas.
Book titles always intrigue me. What to name something that takes so much time for you to research and write and edit. I'm just curious, how did you come up with the title, The Water Will Come?
Well, I didn't. my publisher came up with it. I loved it. I originally had a couple of titles for the book. The first was, I had written this book was kind of based on a Rolling Stone story I did about Miami called Goodbye Miami. And because Miami is a kind of central character in a lot of the book, I thought about naming the book Goodbye Miami and then some kind of a subtitle. And then I had the idea of calling it Letters from Atlantis, which nobody was very excited about. And then I turned the book in and we were just noodling around and I don't actually know who came up with it, if it was my editor or someone else at a meeting, but he called me and said, what do you think of this title? And I immediately loved it. And I loved it because of two things. One is the sort of biblical quality about it. And the other is it really explains a certain point that's really important about this book and about climate change and about what I'm talking about here, which is that, you know, the sea level rise is going to happen. It's not something that we're going to stop even if we, you know, quit burning fossil fuels tomorrow, which of course we're not going to do. But even if we did, we would still, because of the amount of heat that's built up in the Earth's oceans and things and the kind of heat inertia that we already have, we would still see significant amounts of sea level rise. So I loved the title immediately, and it's I think it's been a big reason for the book's success.
Yes, I love it because it really does convey the inevitability of it. And like you said, it doesn't matter if we were to stop doing all of our industrial activity today. As you said, the inertia of climate change is already in ongoing thing, and the ocean is going to expand and rise. It's just a matter of how much.
Exactly.
Let's talk about some of the places featured in your book. You mentioned Miami, which is where you kind of used as the starting point. Tell us a bit about Miami, because Miami and Miami Beach, we're really seeing that happening now, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. I mean, that's, you know, the genesis of this book was when I went down there after Hurricane Sandy, and I happened to be there during King Tides in the fall, which are the highest tides of the year. And I was walking around Miami Beach in this neighborhood where there were, you know, condos were selling for $10 million, you know, knee high in seawater. And it just sort of blew my mind that even then, you know, this was 4 years ago, at high tide, we were seeing that much water sort of already inundating the city. And, you know, and once you go down there and you think about it for a few minutes and talk to a few people, it becomes very clear the problems for Miami, which are, you know, 70% of Miami-Dade County is below 6 feet above sea level. So it's very flat. You have a whole lot of real estate, as anyone knows who's been to Miami, built right on the water. So it's very vulnerable that way. And you also, the hardest thing and that makes it so difficult to defend is that it's basically all built on Swiss cheese. It's built, all of Miami is built on a kind of limestone that's porous. So you can't build seawalls like you can, say, in New York or in San Francisco or somewhere like that, because the water will just go right underneath. So it makes Miami Beach and Miami-Dade County, all of South Florida, actually, incredibly vulnerable to even modest amounts of sea level rise. I mean, even, you know, 2 feet of sea level rise will be devastating for South Florida. And, you know, we're sure to get that in the next, even in the next few decades. So Miami's the sort of poster child for a great American city that is hugely vulnerable in the very near future to this.
Well, someplace that's not a great American city, but a place of great American power is the Norfolk area and the naval base there. You talk about what's going on there. And that also happens to be in a place where climate change denial is really, you know, that's a hotbed of it. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, Norfolk is really interesting. So I was lucky enough to visit Norfolk Naval Base, which is the largest naval base in the world. And it's the center for, you know, the U.S. military or U.S. Navy operations in the Middle East. Six aircraft carriers are call it home. 75,000 people work there. It's an enormous, enormous, you know, naval complex. And it's also in one of the places that is most vulnerable to sea level rise on the East Coast, partly because of the area. In addition to rising seas, you have some subsiding land there also. So the first time I went there, you know, there was water all over the streets and, you know, on the base and everything. And I had a really amazing opportunity to return a second time with then Secretary of State John Kerry. And I happened to be on the bridge of the USS San Antonio with him. It was the 250th anniversary of the Marine Corps. He was there to honor that and to celebrate that. And of course, Secretary Kerry understood the risks of climate change and sea level rise very, very well. And we were on the bridge of this ship, and he asked the commander of the base, how much time does this base have given the, you know, sea level rise? And the commander of the base said, you know, 20 to 50 years. And it was just an extraordinary moment to be there and realize, you know, and to hear the commander of the biggest base in the U.S. Navy telling the Secretary of State that within 20 years, perhaps as early as 20 years, they would have to move or do something about this base. And, you know, what's really important is that, you know, the problem that the base sort of embodies is that, you know, the military has a lot of money, right? They have, you know, $1 million gold-plated toilet covers and all that kind of thing. I mean, they if they want to spend money on something, they can do it. But the problem is that even if you wanted to build big walls around the base, and, you know, obviously this is a naval base, so, you know, the boats can float at any level, but there's problems with the piers and all that. But even if they put billions of dollars into raising and kind of walling off the base from the sea level rise, the problem is that the rest of the region will still be going under, and it doesn't do any good to build a fortress on the sea if nobody can get there because the roads are underwater, because the railroads that deliver the arsenals and materials the base needs are underwater, if housing prices collapse in the area so nobody wants to live there. So it's a real problem for the Navy because they're basically forced with either, you know, moving the base and letting the place go under, or trying to kind of restore and, you know, protect the entire region, which is a very, very expensive and complicated process. They're actually not even legally allowed to do, but that could be changed. But it's a great example of, you know, with sea level rise, even if you fix your, raise your house or protect your house, if the infrastructure around you, you know, the roads, the airports, all that kind of thing go under, what good is it to have an elevated house or a protected naval base?
And it's just amazing because that is such a seat for United States military power, and it's such a vulnerable place.
And, you know, as most people know, you know, closing or moving a military base is, you know, an incredibly difficult and fraught thing to, politically fraught thing to do, because that entire region, you know, there's 75,000 people who work there. I mean, it's the entire area is, you know, dependent upon that base. So if that base moves or is radically reduced in size or something, it will have huge economic impacts on the in the area. But, you know, it was, on the other hand, it was really kind of inspiring to spend some time with the Navy there, because they were very clear-eyed about the risks they were facing, not just with sea level rise, but also with climate change in general. And one of the commanders said to me, you know, it's our job to deal with the world as it is, not as we wish it to be. And, you know, so they are very kind of practical minded about dealing with climate change. And they're not, there's not, to my experience, not a lot of deniers or anyone in the, that I encountered in my, you know, I talked to a lot of people who they can see that this is happening. They have to deal with it all the time. And in fact, military commanders have been out pretty outspoken about how changing climate and sea level rise and more intense storms is, you know, what Secretary of Defense called a threat multiplier. It just, you know, makes the threats that we already have, you know, even it amplifies them by, you know, creating climate refugees, by putting people on the move, by making people vulnerable. You know, they understand very well the risks of climate change.
Let's take a short break. We're talking to Jeff Goodell, author of the new book, The Water Will Come, about the future of sea level rise on our civilization. I'm Dave Shlom. Stay with us. Back. Let's continue our conversation with Rolling Stone contributing editor Jeff Goodell, author of the new book, The Water Will Come. Well, let's talk about the climate refugee problem a bit. One of my favorite parts of the story is, I hope I pronounced this right, you talk about a man by the name of Benedict Kabua Madison in Arkansas. Could you tell us a bit about his story?
Oh, he's fascinating. So I went to the Marshall Islands to, you know, one of the places that are most at risk is the Pacific Islands and other low-lying islands like the Maldives, you know, for places that we've been talking about, like Miami and Norfolk, you know, it's sea level rise is, you know, has tremendous economic and political implications. But for these Pacific Islands, it means, you know, their entire nation basically vanishes and goes underwater. These nations are very, very low-lying, and it won't take very much sea level rise to make them not only uninhabitable, but underwater. And so they're facing, you know, essentially an existential crisis. And the Marshall Islands are a particularly interesting example because of their relationship with the U.S. that by something called the Compact of Free Association there, because of the damage we did to the Marshall Islands during nuclear testing in the 50s and 60s, they're allowed to kind of come to the United States freely and work here, and they don't have to worry about visas and things like that. So I, because I was really interested in where people from the Marshall Islands will go. And it turns out that a lot of Marshall Islanders are going to Arkansas, and there's an entire community in Arkansas, in Springdale, Arkansas, of Marshall Island refugees who basically work in the chicken industry there, or Tyson and Purdue and another big chicken, outfits. And I met this guy named Benedict, who you mentioned. He was from a sort of royal family in the Marshall Islands. He was 21 or 22 years old when I met him, and was going to school, going to junior college. And, but he said unabashedly to me that he was going to be the president of the Marshall Islands one day, and that, he was sort of the sort of president in waiting. And, because of the way the lineage works in the Marshall Islands, I kind of believe him that's a kind of real possibility. But he was very articulate with me about, thinking about how to deal with this problem of his nation going under, the rich nations of the world, who are the ones who are doing all the polluting, kind of owe to the islands and places that are going under. I mean, that's one of the central kind of difficulties of all the climate conversations and negotiations in the in these international climate talks, is like, what does the rich nations owe to the poor nations? The rich nations are the ones who are causing the problem. The poor nations are the ones who are suffering. And he was strikingly articulate about that. And so we wandered around Springdale, Arkansas. I wandered around with the future president of the Marshall Islands, talking about the sort of, existential risks of his Pacific Island nation.
Which certainly could be completely underwater.
Yeah, I mean, it will be completely underwater. It's just a question of when.
When?
Yeah. So.
Yeah, that was an amazing part of the story. I really was struck by the power of that particular one. Let's talk a bit about, you mentioned also when you were in Norfolk, I think it was there, that, they have a way of like speaking in code in these places about sea level rise and climate change, kind of like... I think you referred to the analogy was middle schoolers talking about sex.
Right. So, this was at Norfolk, this became clear to me because at the naval base there, because when I was there, I noticed that a couple of these, they have these enormous concrete piers that the battleships and aircraft carriers, pull up to. And I noticed that several of them were new, and the new ones were, 3 or 4 feet higher than the old ones. So I said to one of the base commanders, did you raise these piers because of sea level rise? Is that why you did it? Because you were thinking ahead. And he said, basically to me, he said, yes, but we couldn't say that, because if we said we were doing it because of sea level rise, then Congress would not appropriate the money because of the Republicans in Congress who redline anything that has anything to do with climate change, which they want to pretend doesn't exist. So, they had to make up reasons basically to excuses to why they wanted to make this pier higher. And it was a great example of the kind of double talk that, the military has to go through because of the politicalization of the phrase climate change. They know they have to do it and deal with it, and they're trying their best to do it, but they can't openly talk about it, because if they do, then it's politically incorrect, and the Republicans in Congress will, not just Republicans, some Democrats too, but mostly Republicans, will X out their budget. And so they end up playing this game of double talk and hiding their true intentions because they can't afford to admit it.
You mentioned being with President Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry, and being with them and listening to them talk about climate change. It's just stunning, the contrast right now we have in this country with where we are now with the current administration.
Oh yeah, I mean I was. Lucky enough to go to Alaska with President Obama in September of 2015, as he was trying to build momentum and draw attention to climate change to get a deal done in Paris, because that was really important to him as one of his last accomplishments in his second term. So they invited, they basically invited one journalist to go with him to write about this trip and to highlight it, and I got to go. I got to be the one. And, you know, I was not an apologist for Obama. I had written quite critically about him on many things, and I was prepared to write very critically about him on this trip. But, you know, I had the extraordinary opportunity of, like, sitting down, and we were up in a little town called Kotzebue, Alaska, in the far north above the Arctic Circle, or in the Arctic Circle. And I had an hour and a half alone with President Obama to talk about climate change. It was really extraordinary because, you know, he didn't know what I was going to ask him about. They didn't ask me for questions ahead of time or anything. So it was really just a sort of, you know, I could have asked him anything about this. And I have a really good kind of BS detector for people who understand climate change and climate politics and climate science and people who've just read notes about it. And he was extraordinary. I mean, he really understood all this. We had different ideas about the politics of it, but the depth of his knowledge about climate change and the risks that we face politically and economically were incredible to me. I mean, it was just really striking. And I think about what that conversation would be like with our current president. And it, you know, it was just like a joke, right? I mean, our current president obviously wouldn't sit down with someone like me to have that conversation anyway. But he, you know, President Trump knows nothing about this and doesn't care at all about this.
Well, on that happy note, we're almost out of time, but I'd like to get your impressions on what should we be watching for the next few years, the next decade or so, as indicators of what's going on with our sea levels.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, what happens in the next few years is not really important. I mean, because we know what's going to happen in the future. I mean, I think the signs of things getting really kind of scary and out of hand are what we see happening in especially Antarctica. You know, earlier this year, there was a big ice shelf cracked off and broke off, and that was got a lot of coverage in the news. And the ice shelf itself is not a problem because it's already floating, but it holds back the ice sheets behind it. So if we start to see more and more kind of cracking up in Antarctica especially, and also, you know, more glacier calving in Greenland. I mean, those are the big deal. That's where sea level rise comes from. And those are the kind of leading indicators of where this is all going. But the important thing is that we know this is going to happen and that we need to start preparing for it anyway, whatever happens in the next 5 years. So we know that over the next couple of decades, this is going to happen. And we don't know exactly how fast it will happen. But all things right now are pointing towards faster rather than slower. And so we need to start thinking seriously on two tracks. One, cutting carbon emissions as fast as we can, and then the other, beginning to adapt to a different kind of world, because we're going to be living in a very different world in the coming decades, no matter what we do right now.
Thanks to our guest, Jeff Goodell. Jeff's a contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine and the author of The Water Will Come: Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. Check out past episodes on mynspr.org or subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our communications coordinator is Casey Gardner. Follow us on Twitter at @NSPRNews and me at Dave Shlom. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Our engineer and co-producer is the man on the board, Nolan Ford. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.